Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hey there. If you've ever struggled to get your toddler to stay in bed, or your middle schooler to do their homework, or maybe your teenager to stick to curfew, I think you're going to love today's conversation. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tony. I'm super excited about today's guest, Dr. Ross Green, and we're going to really take a deep dive into the whole area of behavior modification. You know, this is really interesting to me because so many parents come into my office all the time and they want to address behavioral difficulties in their children. So I'm excited to talk to Ross Green today.
Oh, me too. He has gold for our parents. He's the founder of Lives in the Balance, and he teaches parents and experts and professionals internationally about his parenting solution known as collaborative and proactive solutions. So, Rob, what about Ross Green's work caught your attention as a pediatrician?
Well, you know, the field of behavioral modification in psychology is super interesting. It's fascinating. I mean, it started in the 30s with a psychologist named John B. Watson, who was famous for saying that he could take any child and create a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer just by externally manipulating that child's environment. And then that, of course.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. How long did it take to debunk that theory?
Well, I think people realized pretty quickly that it was much more complicated than that.
Okay.
But he had quite a following for a while, and it did influence the field of psychology for many, many years afterwards.
Sure.
And led to, you know, people like B.F. Skinner, you know, the Skinner box. You learned about that in psychology in your first year courses in university, where operant conditioning was used to really make rats do pretty well anything you wanted them to do by positively reinforcing them or negatively reinforcing them to produce certain behaviors.
Have you ever tried to train a dog?
Oh yeah. We had two dogs when I was growing up, Tuffy and Goya. So
Tuffy, did Tuffy live up to her name name?
Exactly.
Was it a he or a she?
I even forget. I think it was a she, but you know, if you wanted to have a dog that's tough to train, you just call it Tuffy. How about you? Did you ever have a dog that you trained?
Oh, we had dogs growing up. So I have had that experience. Yeah. More recently, we did some training with a super smart poodle called Wilco.
All right.
Wilco learned
how
to, well, he learned how to play the piano.
What?
For a treat.
Play the piano? I thought dogs could just roll over.
No, this is a smart poodle.
No kidding. Well, but how'd you do that?
Treats.
Okay. Yeah.
And then he learned that if he wanted a treat, all he had to do was get up and start plinking his paws on the piano.
Okay. Well, I can see how, you know, parents might be tempted to train their kids to play piano that way. But what I'm excited about is how Ross Green really takes a deep dive into really taking a step back from the idea of simply behavior modification with external factors.
Like rewards and consequences.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's a role for that in parenting, but eventually we want to go deeper than that and really address like what's the root of that behavior. Because we all know that just simply unilaterally imposed solutions don't stick. And that's true in many areas of life.
Sure. Yeah, not just parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Many of our parents may have already heard of today's guest, Dr. Ross Green. He's written a hugely popular book called The Explosive Child, also Lost at School, Raising Human Beings, and other books. He's an international speaker and also international faculty member, including his previous appointment at Harvard Medical School. And he's been on all the major media outlets, including The Oprah Show. So we are so excited to have Dr. Ross Green here today to talk about collaborative and proactive solutions in parenting.
Yeah.
Let's jump in.
For sure.
Dr. Green, welcome to the Smart Family Podcast.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
Yeah. We'd love to talk to you more about the collaborative and proactive solutions and how that relates to a collaborative relationship between parents and their children, but really any caregiver and their children. How and why did you become interested in proactive and collaborative parenting styles that you've written so much about it and researched it so much?
Well, you know, I was trained sort of in what we might call a more traditional model of parenting, and just was finding that it wasn't especially productive for a lot of families. And then just started trying on some new ideas. So, you know, I was trained on how to teach parents how to give timeouts and how to use sticker charts. And there are many families that timeouts actually made family life worse. And there were many kids who, even when it wasn't even a punishment, even when it was just a reward that they didn't get, they were still losing their minds. Worked with a lot of families and taught a lot of parents how to use timeout and contingency contracts. And just I noticed that there were many, many kids that were not benefiting and many families that were still suffering even having implemented that approach to things. And that's when I started trying out some new things and some new ideas. I noticed that in many instances, parents needed help prioritizing things that their kids were struggling with because they were trying to work on everything at once. Many parents were using power as the primary ingredient toward trying to achieve change with their children. Many parents thought that parenting was primarily about being in control. And so I found that there were many things about how many people were going about parenting that I started really having some questions about. But the main motivator was just seeing that the traditional approach to things wasn't working for a whole lot of kids and a whole lot of families.
Yeah, I mean, when I see kids in my practice, and I have a primarily behavior and mental health focused practice, the goal, or at least the focus, is often what can we do about this child's behavior? So the things that come to my attention are kids flipping desks at school, swearing at their parents, you know, walking out of the classroom. But you talk about a child's behavior as being the downstream effect of incompatibility. Can you explain what you mean by that? And what are some examples of incompatibility that you hear from the parents that you work with?
Sure. Behavior is just the signal. All behavior is the signal or the fever. It's the way that a kid is communicating that there are expectations that he or she is having difficulty meeting. All behavior is. Challenging behavior anyways. If all we're focused on is the behavior, then we're focused on what's happening after a kid is having difficulty meeting a particular expectation, whether that expectation is brushing your teeth before you go to bed at night, that is followed by screaming and swearing. Mm-hmm. Screaming and swearing is the behavior. The problem is that the kid's having difficulty brushing his teeth before he or she goes to bed at night. If the kid is struggling with homework and throwing things across the room. Throwing things across the room is the behavior. It comes after the expectation that the kid was having difficulty meeting. We human beings are not at our best when we are responding reactively and emergently and when things are already hot in the first place. And so when I refer to upstream and downstream, downstream is the behavior. Upstream are the problems that are causing those behaviors. So the two terms that I use synonymously are unmet expectation and unsolved problem. The proof that a problem is not yet solved is the fact that a kid is still having difficulty meeting that expectation, that it is still causing challenging behavior. There's all the proof we need. If all we're doing is focusing on the behavior, the signal, the fever, you know, you might make a dent in the behavior that way, but you are solving zero problems that way. But as the research has been telling us for a very long time now, if you are busy identifying and solving the problems that are setting in motion that behavior, not only does the behavior subside, the problems get solved.
But a lot of parents will say that the behavior sort of comes out of the blue or comes out of nowhere. But you're saying that generally there's an iceberg underneath that tip of the iceberg. Is that what you're saying?
Not just generally. Almost always. Mm-hmm. I am very accustomed to having parents, educators, you name it, staff in facilities tell me that the kid's behavior comes from out of the blue and is unpredictable. That is, I want to say always, but I want to leave room for the rare exception. That is almost always untrue. But here's the interesting thing. You're not looking at the behavior in this model anyways. the expectations the kid is having difficulty meeting reliably are highly predictable. And therefore, there's absolutely no reason for us to find ourselves in the heat of the moment with this kid. And by the way, the reason that's a big deal, just as a concrete example, you know, aside from the fact that dealing with life in the heat of the moment is not ideal timing anyways, in Canada and in the United States, the use of restraint and seclusion in schools has been in the news quite a bit lately. Mm-hmm. And a lot of schools are very proud of the fact that they have provided their teachers with what they call crisis prevention training, except that it's not crisis prevention training. It's crisis management training. It's called crisis prevention training. But what most so-called crisis prevention training programs are teaching people how to do is recognize when a kid is becoming escalated, you're already late. And then if your de-escalation efforts fail, how to safely restrain and seclude a kid. Now you are way, way, way late. But what sets in motion the whole sequence and expectation that a student was having difficulty meeting? That's upstream. Everything else is downstream. Unsolved problems are highly predictable. Behavior is just the signal that's telling us something we already knew. This kid is having difficulty meeting this expectation.
We would just love to jump into your thoughts about how you get parents away from solving problems for their kids and instead do what you call Plan B and involve kids in solving those problems. Can you say a few words about plans A, B, and C and what those mean?
Sure. Well, what I've done with plans A, B, and C is the whole goal of plan A, B, and C is to make life simple. When it comes to dealing with those unsolved problems, there's basically three ways in which we adults approach unsolved problems in kids: plan A, plan B, and plan C. Plan C is where we are setting aside a particular expectation, at least for now. Because there are many, many kids out there who have many, many unsolved problems. Those problems have piled up over time because people weren't busy solving those problems. All people were busy doing was trying to modify the behaviors that were the byproduct of those problems. And if all we're doing is paying attention to the behavior, then once again, the problems don't get solved. So many kids have a very big pile of problems that have accumulated over time. We are not going to be able to solve them all at once. We have to prioritize the ones that we have consciously and deliberately decided we're not working on that one right now. We're just going to let it go for now. That's plan C. That leaves us with only A and B. Both A and B represent a way to solve a problem with a kid. But there is one massive distinction between them. With plan A, you're solving the problem unilaterally. With plan B, you're solving the problem collaboratively. When you're using the collaborative and proactive solutions model, you are almost never using plan A, except under circumstances of surprising and emergent safety issues.
Right.
The problem-solving methodology that you're using in this model, because 99% of the problem-solving you're going to be doing when you're using this model is planned and proactive, is collaborative, plan B. So we adults, most of us who have forgotten what it was like to be a kid, are solution machines. You tell an adult a problem a kid is having, and they are at the ready with 57 different solutions. What I find, though, is that the persuasion part isn't that hard, but I have a bit of a biased sample. The people who are seeking me out, whether they are educators or parents or staff in facilities, are not having success either being unilateral or in shutting kids out of the problem-solving process. And at a logical level, why would you want to leave the kid out of the loop on solving a problem that affects his or her life anyhow? Isn't problem-solving one of the absolute most important skills, maybe the most, this kid is going to need for life in the real world? So it's always a very fascinating thing that people say to me, isn't plan A the real world? Actually, no. I don't come across plan A that often in the real world. When I'm having difficulty meeting an expectation, generally speaking, I'm not getting unilateral solutions thrown at me. Now, if I'm speeding in my car, I might get a unilateral solution thrown at me by the police officer.
Yeah, I try to negotiate in that situation, but it's not very effective.
And I'm not very good at turning on the tears at the click of a switch.
Yeah.
If I'm refusing to put my seatbelt on an airplane that's about to take off, I might get a unilateral response. But generally speaking, real world, real life demands collaboration and demands working with people on solutions that are realistic and mutually satisfactory. So my biased sample, I'm working with people who are mostly having no success and are paying a very high price for the fact that they are being unilateral and reactive with kids. Mm-hmm. So I don't find the persuasion part to be that difficult. I can justify it on a logical level, but bottom line is most of the time these people are desperate and seeking answers that are completely different than what they're doing now.
But let me just push back on that a little bit, because let's say I, as a parent, and I have four kids myself, so, and they're all sort of entering preteen years. Let's say I've decided that, I don't want my kids on Snapchat until they're 13. And so when my 11-year-old comes and say, "Hey, Dad, can I download Snapchat?" I've already, my mind said, well, this is kind of a non-negotiable solution. So aren't there any expectations or rules that are in that way sort of quote unquote non-negotiable? Or should I say, well, let's collaboratively problem solve this, but I've kind of collaboratively problem solved it in my own mind already.
Well,
and I'm kind of pushing back a little bit here. And
can you collaborate with yourself, I guess, is the big question.
Yeah.
But actually what you have is not a solution. You have an expectation, right? Your expectation is that your child will not use Snapchat until a certain age. If your child meets that expectation, then there's no need for you to do anything differently. Right. That is a met expectation.
Yep.
The plans come in on unmet expectations. So if a child is brushing his teeth as well and as often as you'd like him to before he goes to bed at night, you do not need a plan. You have a met expectation. It's not an unsolved problem. No plan needed. If your kid is doing homework as well and as often as you'd like him to, no plan needed. It's a met expectation. It's not an unsolved problem.
Right.
So what you have there with the Snapchat is an expectation, not a solution. If your kid is meeting it, you're good to go. If your kid is not meeting it, you have three options. With plan C, you're dropping it because you have bigger fish to fry. Mm-hmm. With plan A, you are being unilateral and saying something like, if you should download Snapchat, you will lose your cell phone. I've decided it.
Right.
And if you are willing to collaborate on that and willing to listen to your kid's concerns, by the way, kid probably has some legitimate concerns, like the fact that probably almost every 11-year-old out there is on Snapchat.
Right.
Then you might be able to collaborate with your kid. But I just want to make it clear, when you're saying, I don't want you to get on Snapchat until you're 13 years old, that's just an expectation. You haven't even come to solutions yet because you have no need for a solution yet. If your kid is meeting that expectation, there's no problem.
Right. So what you're saying is it's always better to collaborate. And the end result may still be that, you know, there's no Snapchat until this certain age. But as a parent, you should be open to listening to the child and listening to their concerns, if at most to model how to solve these sorts of problems.
Yeah, why not? What are we scared of?
Exactly. What's there to lose? Right. Well, so, I mean, what are some kids scared of? I mean, what about the fact that parents might feel like they're losing control, or they might embolden a child to push their wants and agendas, or kind of make us look weak? But I guess those are pretty poor reasons.
Well, those are lens issues. Those are lenses that people wear. American presidents suffer from the same thing. If you don't bomb another country, then you're weak. Mm-hmm. Actually, Sometimes it takes more strength not to just drop a bomb. Sometimes it takes more strength to collaborate with your kid, hear what your kid has to say. Actually, sometimes you are demonstrating more authority by being willing to listen to your kid and work it out together. Sometimes the definition of an authority figure, this is Plan C here, sometimes the definition of an authority figure is that you are willing to drop an expectation that it is crystal clear this child cannot meet. That's an authority figure too. So I think we have to broaden our definition of authority here. If authority means I say jump, you say how high, that's pretty darn narrow.
Ross, would you mind if we just back up a little bit and take the example of Rob's daughter, the 11-year-old, wanting to be on Snapchat, and just let our listeners know about the three steps that you recommend in Plan B?
Sounds like a good idea. When you're solving a problem collaboratively and proactively, you are using three steps. The first step is called the empathy step. The second step is called the define adult concern step. And the third step is called the invitation step. The names don't matter that much. The ingredients matter a great deal. The main ingredient of the empathy step is information gathering. Gathering information from the kid about what's making it hard for the child to meet that expectation. As I always say, kids have information we very badly need. Information about what's hard, information about what's getting in the way, their concern, their perspective, their point of view. If we do not get that information, this problem will not get solved. Step number two, as I always also say, your best source of information on what's making it hard for a kid to meet a particular expectation is the kid. What I always tell people is that they're going to have many jaw-dropping moments in the empathy step when they are learning about their kid, when they're communicating with their kid, when their kid is communicating with them. The biggest complaint I get from parents and other adults is that the kid won't talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The complaint I get from kids is that the adults won't listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get those complaints when we're doing Plan B. And by the way, so far, just by hearing the kid's concerns, you have not given in. You have not given up. You're just listening.
Right.
Second step is the define adult concern step. This is where you, the adult, are entering your concern into consideration. We adults have very important concerns as well. How is this affecting the kid? How is it affecting other people? If all we do is lay down the law, the kid never really hears our concern. They just hear our solution and they hear that they must comply.
Right.
That's what I would call teaching kids how to blindly adhere to authority.
Mm-hmm.
I think history has taught us that blind adherence to authority is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Rather have a kid who can think.
Absolutely. And if I can just ask you, what do you tell a parent who has emotional problems getting through that adult concern part? Like, I would imagine in some cases, parents are talking to their kids about something that they really feel scared about, or, their concerns are so deep that it's hard to have the conversation. How do you coach parents to sort of calm down so they can express their concerns without getting derailed?
You know, this is a pretty structured process. I find that most of the emotion between kids and adults occurs when we are engaged in what we might call competing solutions or a power struggle, right? This is where an adult is trying to impose a solution and a child is trying to impose right back,
right? Yeah.
That's when people tend to get emotional. That's, by the way, also when adults feel like they're going to lose control. But because Plan B is very structured, it does take some of the emotion out of the mix, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kids get less emotional when they feel like their concerns are being heard.
Sure.
Adults get less emotional when they feel like their concerns are being heard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So But if this is a topic that is emotional for a parent, perhaps because of history, their own, perhaps because of what they're scared could happen to their kid, those are legitimate adult concerns, right? Those are things, bad things, they don't want to have happen to their kid. And you know what? If one of the two parties sheds a tear in the expressing of their concerns, so be it. But at least they're not screaming at each other, because now at least they know they're being heard. And now they're not threatening each other. They're not trying to impose solutions on one another. They're listening. The shedding of a tear is not so terrible when we're listening to each other.
So you talked about the first two steps. You talked about the empathy step and the defining adult concerns. And then what's the third step?
Third step is called the invitation. That's where kid and caregiver are collaborating on a solution. But, and this is very important, a solution that must meet two criteria. Got to be realistic, meaning both parties can truly do what they're agreeing to do. I find it fascinating that we adults often sign off on solutions that we already know the kid can't do. I was just in a meeting in a school where they told me that the solution that they had come up with a kid. And I said to them, now in your mind's eye, can you really picture that student doing that solution? And they said, no. And I said, all right, then we don't have a solution yet.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Not pie in the sky. It's not wishful thinking. It's, can this kid really do this? The other criteria is that the solution has to be mutually satisfactory, meaning the solution truly addresses the concerns of both parties. If a solution isn't realistic and mutually satisfactory, this problem is definitely not solved. But you cannot come up with a mutually satisfactory solution unless you know what the concerns of both parties are in the first place. That's why the first two steps come before we start talking about solutions. You can't talk about solutions until you know what concerns you're trying to address. Now, many of our politicians try, but that doesn't mean they're being very productive in the solving of problems.
Yeah. Now, it sounds like with collaboration that there has to be meaningful communication. And yet you talk about collaborating and defining incompatibility right from day one in your book, Raising Human Beings. And on the other end of the spectrum, you know, we get teenagers who, like you said, simply won't talk. You don't get any sort of response from them. So is there sort of a lower age and an upper age to this approach, or really are we seeing a spectrum of how this approach is applied throughout childhood and adolescence?
Well, number one, I find that teenagers who won't talk are teenagers who've had a lot of plan A thrown at them.
They've so shut down.
They think they know what you're about. They think that you're just going to lower the boom. They don't think you're interested in their concerns. Why talk? Mm-hmm. And I've had teenagers say that. Why talk, right? But I've had 8-year-olds say that too. So there is no upper end. You can solve problems collaboratively with adults, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. In fact, that's our goal, right? Is to have adults solve problems like this too.
It sure would be nice. At the lower end, we collaborate with infants. We don't do it through the three steps exactly, but it's pretty darn close. We do try to figure out what's getting in the infant's way. We do try to come up with solutions that will solve a problem: hunger, wet diaper, cold, hot. And then we are actually completely dependent on the infant to let us know how we're doing. That's called collaboration. So no, the infant is not telling you what his or her concerns are. You have to guess, just by the way as you would with a nonverbal 10-year-old, 15-year-old, 30-year-old. You have to guess.
Right.
And you have to take a stab at solutions. But then you learn how well this solution is working and who you're getting that information from: the kid. So there's no lower limit either. Obviously, this is easier when it's being done with the spoken word, but you can collaborate with kids who can't engage in the spoken word. We do it all the time.
Right. And that's infants, but it could also be a child with a language difficulty or communication difficulties like autism, for example. And I guess that's the skill of parenting, is learning how to read some of those nonverbal cues sometimes and say, what is my child saying to me?
Well, and the interesting thing is I think we expect that for parents of infants. The problem is that we stop.
Mm-hmm.
We stop listening. We stop collaborating. And I'm still trying to figure out why. I think that we adults get very threatened when a two-year-old starts exerting his or her will because two important skills have kicked in, language and locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not threatening. That's as exciting as it gets.
Exactly, yeah.
As I talked about in Raising Human Beings, the kid was already somebody. The kid was somebody the minute he popped out,
right?
But now he's going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of adults find that to be extremely threatening. I find that to be as exciting as it gets.
Yeah, no, that's good. I agree with you 100%.
So I would imagine, and you did address this in your book, that you get pushback from people who sometimes say, well, my parents used corporal punishment and I turned out just fine. So what's the problem with that? What do you typically say?
You know, number one, if you can solve problems without being aggressive, if you can solve problems without teaching kids that physical aggression under the guise of love, but still physical aggression, if you can accomplish the mission without physical aggression, wouldn't you wanna?
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. I agree.
Plus, a lot of the things we do, physical aggression solves no problems, teaches no skills. Stickers solve no problems and teach no skills. Suspensions don't, detentions don't, restraint and seclusion don't. These are all behavior modification procedures. I'm not interested in behavior modification. I know from the research that the behavior will improve every bit as much when we engage kids in solving problems collaboratively and proactively as it would have if we were using behavior modification strategies. So even on behavior, behavior modification strategies do not have an advantage. But when it comes to solving the problems that affect a kid's life and teaching a kid how to do that, behavior modification strategies leave me cold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I still hear from schools and other places all the time that, you know, sticker charts and trying to encourage a behavior, you know, where you get smiley face at the end of the day after you've had sort of five or so, you know, good behaviors recorded during the day. But that seems to be more of an extrinsic motivator. I mean, ultimately what we want is an intrinsic motivation for the child to, you know, behave.
Well, and here's the interesting thing. As you know, kids do well if they can is the key theme of this model.
Right.
And kids do well if they can basically says the kid is motivated already. So a lot of people have trouble believing that, but what's getting in the way for kids who are not behaving themselves the way we want them to, is the fact that they are lacking the skills to do it and that there are certain expectations they are clearly having difficulty meeting. We make a massive mistake when we interpret a kid who's doing poorly as being unmotivated and simply turn to motivational strategies to try to help that kid. I'm sure with the best of intentions, but I think it's the wrong turn. When we figure out what a kid's lagging skills are, so we have the right lenses are, this is not lagging motivation, this is lagging skills. And when we figure out what specific expectations the kid is having difficulty meeting, what are his unsolved problems, and we help the kid solve those problems, all of a sudden, all those stickers really didn't make much sense in the first place. And by the way, that is of all the things I say, I always find this fascinating. That is the thing that I say that causes more people more angst than any others. When I am looking askance at stickers, but I'm always telling people, don't let stickers do your blocking for you. A kid can't establish a relationship with a sticker. A kid can't communicate with a sticker. A kid can't solve a problem with a sticker. But most importantly, I've been working for 40 years now with the kids who never get the sticker.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And not getting a sticker didn't move that kid any closer to getting a sticker. And eventually I came to the conclusion, not only was the failure to get a sticker not helping my kids, it was also distinguishing them as the kid who doesn't get the sticker at a very early age. And it also became clear that the kids who were getting the sticker didn't need the sticker. They were intrinsically motivated in the first place. That's why they're doing well. So if they're also doing well because they have the skills, of course. So I'm having trouble. Why would we want to move a kid from intrinsic motivation to extrinsic motivation? We wouldn't want to do that even to a kid who's doing well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see the point even, and I'm never going to stop saying that, because once again, I've been working for 40 years with the kids who don't get the sticker. I've seen zero productive in making sure that kids don't get a sticker when it's skills that they are lacking and when it's unsolved problems that are getting in their way.
And I think one of the reasons why we go to these approaches is because they're relatively easy to implement, and collaborating and listening and going through the steps is harder.
It's easy unless you're taking the long view. The long view is, if you're a kid who for the last 5 years hasn't been getting the sticker and also hasn't been getting the help you needed, that's actually the recipe for losing a kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's not efficient at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, in many ways, our world is becoming a better place and we see progress in many areas, not in all areas, but specifically mental health issues are on the rise. And I'm thinking of anxiety, depression. How do you see an approach like this, collaborative and proactive solutions, to help maybe curb or at least make a dent in this epidemic?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think that the world is a less user-friendly place for kids now than it was 30 or 40 years ago. In the United States, somewhat in Canada, less so in Canada, but more, very much so in the United States,
mm-hmm.
we have high-stakes testing. We have turned many classroom teachers, and they'll say this themselves, into test prep robots. Takes two incomes to produce the lifestyle that one used to.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are very busy. We don't rely on religion like we used to, which I'm neither here nor there on, but where are we getting our bearings from?
Yeah, it was a sense of community for sure.
We are much more transient than we used to be, which is a community issue as well. I think it's much harder to be a kid these days. It is much more competitive. We are much more achievement oriented. Boy, if that doesn't make you anxious or cause you to become depressed, I'm not exactly sure what will.
Yeah.
We need to look at the big picture. But I think it's, life is a lot more pressure packed for kids these days. And I think we need to take a look at that. But if you're asking me, which do I think is going to be more helpful in addressing the epidemic you're talking about? More adult-imposed consequences or solving problems with kids collaboratively and establishing the kind of relationships that I know that the process helps us accomplish? For me, it's a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a thread through your research showing the impact that collaborative and proactive solutions has on building a closer bond between a parent and a child? It seems like that's a much different, much deeper, and potentially a more intimate approach than just imposing behavioral modification strategies. Can you comment on that?
Well, it's interesting because trying to remember which study this is. I might not be able to remember which study it is, but in a few of our studies, we have used the Parenting Stress Index as an outcome measure. And if I'm remembering correctly, when it comes to parents feeling a closer bond with their kid, solving problems collaboratively accomplish the mission much better than imposing adult-imposed consequences does. But there was one finding that was actually fascinating. Parents who learned how to solve problems collaboratively and proactively with their kids actually felt more competent at setting limits than parents who were trained on how to use reward and punishment to set limits.
Wow.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Green, you talk about the bigger picture and really how using this approach in our children is really setting them up for a lifetime of skills. Empathy, listening, being honest, being transparent. So when I was reading The Explosive Child, I was wondering when you're going to write the book, The Explosive CEO or The Explosive Parent, because in a way, it goes both ways. But what does it actually look like in the adult world? And we talked a little bit about the real world already, and it's, you know, it seems to have a predilection for plan A. But really, shouldn't we use this approach in all of our spheres of work and family and spouses should be using this as well?
Of course. And, you know, in the little marital therapy that I've done in my career, if you ask me what was I mostly doing when I was trying to help couples, it was helping them listen, helping them communicate, and helping them come up with solutions between each other that were realistic and mutually satisfactory. There are CEOs who I've talked to who find this to be fascinating and who feel that this would be, you know, the CEOs that I've talked to have said that the workplace, and of course this would make sense, can be a very unilateral place, mm-hmm. can be very much about power. It doesn't have to be. And certainly this has application to the political arena. You know, I, for one, am really tired of seeing these problems that never get solved continue to get tossed around for political advantage instead of finally making headway on them. I'm really growing weary of the power play that how our politicians fake it on solving problems primarily for political advantage. We got problems to solve. The wildfires in Australia are not necessarily unusual, but this magnitude tells us something is going on. And I have difficulty in good conscience accepting the deaths of 500 million animals in that country because of what could potentially be due to climate change. So we've got problems that we need to solve. And I'm getting tired of seeing politicians use that to their political advantage. So there's my political sermon for the podcast.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with that point of view. We need more collaborative problem solving in our world. And if I look at, you know, even negotiation strategies in the adult world, it seems a lot like the adult version of collaborative and proactive solutions. I mean, I look at Harvard negotiation model with, you know, getting to yes, for example, a lot of the words and concepts in there sound very similar to what you're talking about.
Definitely some similarities, especially in the listening department. In the solution generating department, there are less similarities. But anything that comes close, I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were using this in the divorce field too, collaborative divorce law.
Yes.
Very similar concepts.
Very. Mm.
So, Dr. Green, I just want to ask you to point our listeners to where they can find your resources.
They're all on the Lives in the Balance website. Lives in the Balance is my nonprofit. I can't say my nonprofit, but it is the nonprofit that I founded. There is just a boatload of free resources on everything we have spent some time talking about here on the Lives in the Balance website, lives, L-I-V-E-S, in the balance.org. All kinds of streaming video and audio programming and podcasts and just resources galore to take people beyond what they've heard today.
Thank you. And we'll also include a link to your books in our show notes for this episode.
Yeah.
Great.
The Explosive Child, Raising Human Beings. I mean, both and other books as well that you've written. Very helpful. And thank you for providing those resources. for us. Hey, let's hope that this is the start of the next generation learning some of these things better than maybe we did, and that the current crop of parents take something useful from the information that we talked about today.
If my work has made a small dent in that direction, I'm happy.
Dr. Green?
Well, we are too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
My pleasure.
Wow, Tony, wasn't that an amazing interview?
So good.
No kidding. I love that. So next time you get a speeding ticket, are you going to try and use Plan B?
I might have done that before, Rob.
Oh, yeah. Who hasn't, right?
It might have worked with a few tears.
Right, of course. Yeah, and if that officer was engaging his active listening skills, you may have been successful. Who knows?
A bit of collaboration there.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I thought that was just fantastic. I mean, what a lot of excellent information there for parents about really how to bring about positive behavior in their children. So yes. Anyways, I thought that was fantastic.
Yes. Now, I want our listeners to know where to find us, Rob. Mm-hmm. Instagram, we're at Smart Family Podcast. On the interwebs, you'll find us at smartfamilypodcast.com, complete with episodes and blogs and whatever else we have. Please give us your comments. We would love to hear from you. And of course, subscribe. And if you love this episode as much as we love bringing it to you, please share it with your friends. And don't forget to leave a review.
Exactly. Well, thanks for joining us today on the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you build family relationships that last. We want to help you boost your parenting to the next level, and also to help you cut through the noise so that we can show you what works. And why do we do that? Because we want you to love being home. Till next time.